It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies' slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details.
Save big money at Menards.
Have you or someone you know left the behavioral health field? Coming back has its benefits for you and Ohioans in need. We would love to have you back working at a community behavioral health center, and you could earn up to a $3,000 bonus. That's right, a $3,000 bonus. Visit mha.ohio.gov/welcomeback and restart your journey today. That's mha.ohio.gov/welcomeback.
Guys, welcome to the Everyday Warrior Nation podcast. I'm here with John Wellborn and Isra Nasir, who is releasing Toxic Productivity, Reclaim Your Time and Emotional Energy in a World That Always Demands More. If that ain't the freaking truth.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I'm very, very excited to have this conversation with the both of you. And the title was so intentional because it's not just time. The original title, the publishers, editors had talked about just saying time, reclaim your time. But I really feel we put a lot of emotional energy that just goes unaccounted for in all of the things. So thank you for reading out the whole thing. Very few people do it.
No, it's especially those last words, in a world that demands, always demands more. It seems like the speed of business and society as a whole is just go, 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 accomplish, well, which I'm not so totally opposed
points.
To.
Yeah, but I mean, think about the level of access points. Like before, 50 years ago, somebody had to call on the phone. There was no answering machine. Yeah. They had to mail you a letter. You actually had to go to an office and somebody would come in. Now it's like email, text. Like, in a day, I laugh at the different channels that people hit me on things. I get an email. I got a text message. I have Discord. I have Slack. I have Instagram messaging. Like, there's like 50 different ways almost where you can't get away from it. And then we're tied with these things to our hip at all times. So, I mean, how do you ever decompress?
There's a guy who's involved with the Everyday Warrior Nation. We have multiple contributors. His name is Kirk O'Fell. He has a company called Overwatch Mission Critical in the data center industry. Fifth Industrial Revolution. He talks about the unintended consequences of technology, and that's one of them. But yes. Isra, first off, where did you fly in from?
I'm coming in from New York City.
Okay.
This is my first time in Texas or Austin, so I'm having a really great time so far.
Are you staying or right back on a flight?
I'm leaving Friday morning, so I have a couple of days. I want to check out some spots. It's very nice.
Were you talking food or are we talking?
Yeah, food and live music. Everybody keeps saying that live music here is really good. Your face is telling me something different.
So right when I moved to Austin, they're like, "Yeah, we're the music capital of the USA."
I thought it was the live music capital.
And I'm like, if you haven't been to Nashville, it's different.
I have not been to Nashville either.
You haven't been to Nashville.
I'm Canadian, so I haven't been to a lot of America.
Where in Canada?
Toronto.
Toronto.
Okay, yeah. Close enough. I should travel more within the states.
Born and raised Toronto.
No, I was actually. It's a bit of a complicated answer. I was born in Pakistan, but I grew up in the Middle East, and then I moved to Toronto, and then I came to New York.
Mm. Where in Pakistan?
Karachi.
Karachi?
Yeah.
And then your family moved to the Middle East where?
Saudi Arabia.
How'd you like that?
I mean, I was 0 years old when I was there, so okay. I mean, that's all I knew. I was there from 0 to 13, and it was a very bubbled expat experience, so it was very nice. And then moving to Toronto was like the biggest tragedy of my 13-year-old life, you know, because I had to walk to school and it was snowing and we didn't have a car in the beginning, just the traumas of immigration. But within a year, I absolutely fell in love with Toronto. It was a fun childhood there. I mean, as a child, you don't really know the broader world. You know, you live in your little bubble and, I had a fun time. I haven't been back since I was 14.
To Toronto?
To Saudi.
To Saudi?
Yeah.
Okay. What's your pedigree? Because I know you're a licensed therapist.
Yeah, so I am a therapist. I'm licensed in Toronto, in Ontario, and in New York. I'm getting my New York license right now.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
When did you move to New York?
7 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where did you go to school?
I went to school to University of Toronto, and then I went to Adelphi in New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That is quite a pass.
I know, yeah. It's just like a third culture kid. There's just so much movement. Yeah.
So what led to this book? Because there's usually just one, you saw a common thread and then something ignited and you're like, hey, I've got to write this book on toxic productivity.
Yeah, so the book actually comes out of my own experience of trying to understand why I was feeling so disconnected in life a couple of years ago. And because I'm a therapist, I really tend to, my defense mechanism is wanting to read more to understand why I'm feeling what I'm feeling. About 5 years ago, I started feeling very disengaged from my life. I was doing a lot of things, and from the outside, you would think that this girl's life is amazing. She goes out all the time. She's lives in Manhattan. She has this great job at a startup. Like, everything is working for her. But I was really, really disconnected. And so at first I thought I was depressed. So I did like a self-assessment and I didn't meet the criteria. And then I started paying attention to what I was saying yes to, where my energy is going, read a lot of research articles, and I ended up with a lot of thoughts on why so many people feel this way, and that eventually became this book.
You make an interesting point, is external perceptions are often wrong. I mean, the one that always blows my mind is Anthony Bourdain. Mm-hmm. Like, that guy was the GOAT. Mm-hmm. Like, binged on all his shows, and then all of a sudden...
Yeah.
Well, takes his own life.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, he lived in a hotel. I mean, like, he's, you know, filming his show. And I was always an Anthony Bourdain fan. And, like, you know, he was such a lonely guy. And then he clicks on, he Googles his girlfriend and sees a picture of her out with another guy, you know, with Page Six in New York, and ends up, you know, allegedly committing suicide as a result of it. I mean, how, like, for a person of his character and, like, you know, where he was in his life, I mean, you can't imagine somebody with more success.
Yeah.
I mean, had his own TV show. I mean, did jujitsu. I mean, had he's kind of this cultural icon. I mean, there isn't a day I don't see somebody at least post some form of, like, picture or meme or something with Anthony Bourdain with some, you know, incredibly insightful quote.
I just looked him up yesterday because I wanted to see his recommendations for Texas barbecue.
Oh.
You know, so, like, he is in our cultural consciousness in a very powerful way. But
are you interested in Texas barbecue? Because I moved here from California in, like, late 16, early 17, uh-huh. and we went to every single barbecue place almost every weekend for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
To the point where I haven't eaten barbecue since, like, 2019 unless somebody comes to town uh-huh. and wants to go, and I'll be like, okay, we'll go eat barbecue. My kids and my wife won't even eat it anymore. Yeah. We went everywhere.
My husband is into it, so he wanted to go.
So, yeah. Will, what's the iconic place? He's a master griller.
Aaron Franklin.
Franklin Barbecue.
Okay.
The weight, though, I think Black's, in terms of their beef rib, is Terry Black's is as good as I've ever had.
That's where we went yesterday.
Yeah, that beef rib is, like, worth it.
I'm pescatarian. So I just had the mac and cheese. It was very sad because it smelled amazing.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
It is. But to John's point, I think if you overload on it, it's just the greasy and the weight of it.
It's
just
too much.
Gets, yeah.
Yeah, it's
too much.
It did seem like a lot. There was a lot on his plate.
Yeah, it is a lot. And it's a lot of flavors and it's really rich. And you get to the point where you're like, I don't know if I can do this all the time. Yeah. But like brisket, I mean, now I just have, like, broken myself. Some people are like, oh, do you love barbecue? I'm like, maybe.
I'll take a steakhouse over a barbecue now. And we've got no shortage of steakhouses, and I know you're a pescatarian. So it seems like everywhere you turn on social media, you just see people just lose, like, even the airports. Like, I've seen some people lose it in the airports because I'm in an airport every week.
Yeah.
But I know one of the primary tenets or things that you discuss in the book is understanding our emotions. And it just seems, as a society, we're getting worse. Like, people are not, like, emotional regulation is just not there. And I know that's painting in broad brushstrokes, but dive into how, you know, you felt disconnected, you felt dysregulated. What in the book is really sort of the primary purpose behind understanding your emotions, and how does that segue into just living a more regulated, stress-free life?
Yeah. I think emotional regulation is the key foundational skill if you want to be happy, if you want to have balance, and if you want to have sustainable productivity. I think when we talk about, you know, ambition and career and living on timelines, the one thing that we don't talk about enough is how important our emotions are when we make decisions. You know, we often want to shut off our emotional center to make decisions. But I think that if we leverage understanding difficult emotions, we become better decision makers. We become a little bit more creative because we're not burdened by shame. I think shame is a powerful emotion that impacts our productivity, whether it's at work, in your personal life, or even your personal self-growth. If you're using shame to motivate yourself, that's going to maybe help you get started, but it won't keep you going. And so I'm trying to explore some very powerful, what we call negative emotions, you know, colloquially, or they're unhelpful. So things like shame and guilt, things like fear and anxiety, they play such powerful roles in our productivity habits that can really take us to an unhealthy place where we become disengaged, where we become disconnected, and we're going on autopilot. And, you know, it's not the way we should, I don't like using the word should, but it's not the way we should live, because we all deserve to be happier and more balanced than we are right now.
As you're talking, I naturally go to what I did, and what pops up is naturally, you know, when we would lose guys, is you would compartmentalize that and just don't even feel the emotions of it. Like, just leave that for down the road. Mm-hmm. And compartmentalization is good in certain environments, but oh boy, does that pot boil over. Yeah. And it's like worse.
Yeah. Well,
shame's interesting to me. Oh, yeah. I'm really conflicted with it because I look at it in two ways. I think people like, this is something that, have you ever seen anything get pushed on social media where you're like, I didn't even know that was a real thing? And then you're kind of like I was just like, I didn't know, it was actually Steve Weatherford. I don't know if you know him. He was a punter for the New York Giants. Yeah, he's jacked. He like went on this diatribe, I mean, like this huge thing about his porn addiction. Mm. And he was like talking about it. And I was kind of like what, like it just was a weird kind of, I don't know. I mean, he was talking like literally did a ton of stuff about it. I ended up like hitting him up about something else. And we got on the phone and I was like, what's all this porn addiction stuff? And he's like, I was like, what, like, how addicted? Like, is this like, he's like,
I was. Is this for personal reference?
Well, I just was curious. I was like, I don't know, are you watching with your wife? Are you watching? But he's like, I'm driving around in my car with it on and I'm not going home. And I'm literally just like, I'm like listening to it at the gym. I mean, I was like 20 hours a day watching and observing, like, what? And I'm like, I was like, did you show it to anybody? He's like, no, I was shameful. And it was like kind of interesting. And he asked me, I'm like that's not anything that even crosses my, like, I just, it was so weird to me. But then, so that was, I didn't realize that these people have all these like weird things. Like, maybe I'm not deviant enough. Like, I just kind of figure you go wrong. Like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying necessarily, but
well, the vulnerability,
so he talked about the shame of it.
Yeah.
Whereas in my mind, and this is a stupid story, but like when I was in middle school, I grew really fast and I was a fast runner and then I wasn't fast. And we used to have to do these time runs every Friday and I went from getting A's to like getting like a C. And I was so like embarrassed that I was going to have to give my report card to my mom with a C in PE that I went and I talked to my, the teacher and I was like, what can I do? And she's like, well, we have these extra credit runs on Friday. You can run extra and I'll just give you more points and you get your grade up. So I tell my mom, I'm like, hey, I got to do something after school. And I would do these extra credit runs. Mm-hmm. And so I could get an A because I was like so embarrassed. And I don't know if it was shame or just embarrassed that I was going to get a C in PE. And then all of a sudden the next year, like I started lifting weights and like everything figured out. And then I got to go play in the NFL. But like I like legitimately was like so distraught that I was going to get a C in PE. Mm-hmm. Like just seems crazy to me now as a kid. Like, but like that was a huge thing for me. Where I was like, this is weird. And like, I felt shameful, but it drove me to like make a change instead of being like, well, I don't want to do it. I don't want to go to school. I just said to the teacher, and she even said to me, when you go to high school next year and lift weights, all this will fix itself. I've seen this before many times with a lot of guys. And like not knowing the physiology of strength training now, like I know exactly why it fixed everything. But this lady who was my seventh, eighth grade PE teacher, you know, had like a flat top, wore a warm up. I mean, she literally looks like you would expect, like,
Butch.
A seventh inning.
Yeah. Butch.
Yeah. And she was like, oh, yeah, it'll fix itself. But, like, that to me, and when I think of shame, like, that was a shameful moment where I couldn't hold the standard and it forced me to want to do better. Whereas then all of a sudden you hear Steve Weatherford talking about driving around his car for 20 hours watching porn. And I'm like, we must have a different version of shame. Like, that's fucking insane.
I bet that was cathartic for him to show the vulnerability, especially on social media, it was like a weight off his shoulders.
Well, yeah.
And helpful for other people.
Yeah, right? And that's the thing,
like,
the impact.
It really validates. And so I do want to talk a little about what you're talking about with shame. So shame is an incredibly powerful emotion that makes you feel like something is wrong with you. And guilt is an emotion that makes you feel like you did something wrong. Mm-hmm. And they're very closely tied. So sometimes we can feel guilt and we can process it by changing our behavior, right? And then we don't feel it anymore. But if we don't process the guilt, it can transform into shame and become something about your core being. So very high level speaking, in your anecdote, it feels like you realize that you were not doing something good enough and you had the power to change it. So you changed your behavior. And so I would kind of characterize that as like guilt and embarrassment versus shame, right? And shame can be a very powerful starter. It can kickstart you, but if it becomes too infused in like the core being of who you are, it can lead to more intense outcomes, like this other friend of yours that you're talking about, where it becomes so painful that it consumes your whole life. I just wanted to say that.
No, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, like, yeah. like wanting to lift weights and, you know, like I kind of equated playing football with being big and strong.
Yeah.
And like I knew to be good at football, I had to be big and strong. And I knew that like football, if I trained for it, would make me big and strong. Yeah. And like I'm 6'6", and like I lifted weights and like, you know, and I was good at what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of like, but like, I don't know if that would have gone the same way if I hadn't had that moment where all of a sudden I was like I was embarrassed.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not holding that. Like I expect more from myself. This is like I was probably 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And like to the point where like I trained extra and this has been something that's driven me my whole life is like, I was trying to explain this to my daughters. I got twin daughters that like mm-hmm. My daughter was like, well, if I'm really smart, shouldn't I just be naturally good at all this stuff? Like, why should I have to study? Like, that should be an indicator that I'm not smart. And I'm like, the smartest people in the world are the ones that figure out they have to work harder before anybody else.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't good at football because I just was magically good. I was good because I put in all the hours when nobody was watching. Mm-hmm. So then when I showed up, it made it look easy.
Yeah.
And, like, that's, you know, whether it be, you know, I went to Berkeley. I graduated in 4 years. Like, all the things in my life were not because, I mean, I got there and I was able to do well, but it was because of hard work.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I just think shame is such a... is it that people get stuck in these things mm-hmm. or is it something that happens to them? Is it a character? I mean, because there's also another one, which is big is, social media scrolling, like the doom scrolling and being addicted into this social media thing.
Yeah.
And there's a weird shame about it to the point where I'm like, let me see your phone. Let me see how many hours you're on this thing.
Yeah.
And like, and people get like nervous because they've been on their phone for 7 hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a element of people. It's like comparison is the thief of joy.
Mm-hmm.
Is they're just constantly comparing themselves to other people. But this does lead into, you know, I don't think this is accurate or wholly accurate, is that there's been a decline in mental health. One, I think you go to the 40s, 50s, 60s, men were just expected based off a stereotype to compartmentalize their feelings. It wasn't manly to demonstrate vulnerability. But, I mean, it does seem like we are getting worse at emotional regulation. I mean, do you attribute that to education or anything in society where it seems like people are becoming more unbalanced?
I think there's like a convergence of different factors at the time that we're living in. I'll definitely say that there are more people who are dysregulated now by virtue of access to too much information, because our minds are not supposed to be processing this much information at the speeds that we're doing it. And we also have access to more information than we had ever had. You know, 40 years ago, you kind of knew what your neighborhood was doing. Today, you know what's happening halfway across the world and you have constant access to it. So it dysregulates your body and your brain. And I think that also creates comparison. Comparison is also very dysregulating. I don't want to I don't want to wait. You can pause this for a second. Can we swear?
Yes.
Yo, yeah.
Okay. Fuck yes.
Don't leave that.
God damn it, motherfucker. Just say it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't want to shit on social media, but I think there is an element
of... You got to leave that in. That was...
Yes, that's awesome.
Yeah, leave that
in. Awesome. I wasn't expecting that from a doctor.
No,
in podcast.
No, I think it's great. Sorry, go on.
I don't mind
if you shit on social media because I think the root of this thing... Is like what you're talking about is like connections. Like we're like, what are we wired up for? Maybe 100, 125 connections.
Yeah.
And now we have people that are connecting and like have millions of followers. I mean, to me, that almost gives me anxiety.
It is. It's definitely very anxiety provoking. But what it's also done is it's amplified something called the spotlight effect. The spotlight effect is this cognitive dynamic where we feel like everyone is watching us. So in high school, you get one little zit, you think everybody can see it, right? Like you have a little tear. So in high school, we naturally, the way our brains are, we have the spotlight effect. We grow up, we grow older, we regulate it. But being on social media has amplified that for everybody because we feel like everyone is watching everything we do. So there's this pressure to constantly present your best self and version in every area of your life, whether it's parenting, whether it's being a friend, whether it's podcasting, whether it's a hobby. There is this pressure to succeed, which is making everybody extremely wired but disconnected.
So my response to that is just don't post.
You know, it's an interesting paradox because you get left behind if you're not on it. But when you're on it, you're also feeling behind. So there's this like interesting paradox that feeds on itself. And it doesn't just have to be social media. It can be anything. It can be a newsletter you started. It can be the Christmas newsletter that you send to your community. It's just kind of permeated our being right now. And I don't know if getting off social media is the solution, like because there's a lot of benefits to social media. I would want us to have a healthier relationship to social media. In the same way, I don't think that we should just not be productive. I want us to have like a healthier relationship to it. So
why do
to
people
me it's
feel
that.
The need to share so much? Like that's something I go through this all the time. Mm-hmm. For my company, I don't post. So I have my assistant does all this stuff. So she's constantly on me. And one of the things I get into is like, I feel weird sharing my life with people that I don't know. Mm. So like if something happens and somebody's within my friend circle, you know, I'm excited to share things with them and people that come train or people I see, but I don't understand the desire and the need to share intimate details of my life with people that I've never met that don't know me.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of like DMs and questions from people and I'm like, I don't know who these people are. And it may like, and so in the NFL, they pre-social media, they were very, very conscious of educating us to be extremely private. There was like stalkers and weirdos and like, you know, there was constantly like you'd see the same person like everywhere you went and you'd be like, okay, this person's stalking me. And it happened to me numerous times. And they were like, hey, don't give out
what was his name?
It was a girl. dude, you want to hear something crazy? I used to see this girl at training camp and she would always like an autograph. And then all of a sudden I'm at the game and my mom and dad are at the game and there was like a family kind of section. And I see my mom, she's like, this really nice usher walked us down here. And I look and it was the girl. She had gotten the game and found my parents and befriended them. And I was like, Mom, that's the girl that's stalking me. My mom's like, well, she's very nice. And so I was like, well, you guys deal with this. But super weird. But so like I have this like natural aversion to like sharing too much. Whereas now the NFL has encouraged these guys to share every moment of their lives and their, you know, the Travis Kelce, Taylor Swift and this whole thing. Like that gives me anxiety for them. Like how are they supposed to like have a relationship when every optic is on them at all times? And like everybody's trying to interpret this stuff. And I'm like, how do these people live? Like it doesn't look like a fun existence to me.
Yeah, my response to your original question has nothing to do with this conversation, but I'll say it anyway. A social presence and social proof generates revenue. That's it. So if you have a business and you're social facing, if you're a person who's a business and I think that's why people do it. It is an I would never want that life. Right. But if it's generating you like billions of dollars, like look at how much money Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift are generating. right? And so it becomes a vehicle. It becomes like a machinery. And that's why you see a lot of actors kind of cycle through it and then they completely disappear. Mm-hmm. They, like Keanu Reeves, he's completely disappeared off of social media. He just comes in to do interviews and he'll race a car now and then and that's kind of it. Right. So
yeah. It seems amazing. Yeah. Like I think the day, you know, you've made it is when you don't have social media. And the only way people can get in touch with you is to send a fax. I do know a really rich guy who doesn't have a phone. And the only way you get in touch with them is you have to fax him.
Oh my gosh. Fax machines are the most stressful things in the world. I sent my first fax like when I was applying to my master's program and I got so confused by where the paper was going that I just unplugged it because I didn't know what it would do to my transcript that I had just paid $60 for. It was the worst. And then I think I've maybe used a fax two times after that.
Yeah, you scan and you send over email.
Yeah.
But this is, John, we've had this conversation. And it's the same reason, like, we don't have massive followings is because you don't post anything in your life. I won't. And it's funny, you know, Jordan, my wife, will be like, you don't post enough about us. I only post business.
Yeah.
Podcasts. I don't want people in our lives. And I think I go to my background. I'm like, somebody could target me based off of the information I put out.
So
100%.
So my dad was a criminal defense attorney for like 55 years. My mom's actually Canadian.
Oh, nice.
And she was born in south of Calgary and then grew up in Vancouver.
Cool.
So that's where my family's from. But well, my dad was a criminal defense attorney for 55 years. And my brother does the same thing. And my dad's, you know, he passed away a couple years ago. One of his requests was like, don't put the kids on social media. He's like the amount of clients that I've had and perverts and people in jail and this and the way they like, you know, well, people have a lot of time. And he's like, so just do me a favor. Like very occasionally you'll catch like a side glimpse or this or some very like things, but like never head on, never things. And people are like, you know, and even my wife, I told her, I was like, I don't mind if you do some stuff, but like, let's just keep the kids off of it. And like, just very vanilla, just because I like,
that's wise.
It makes me uncomfortable that like there's that many people you don't know that are that clued in on your life, and that just feels weird to me.
But NIL has also changed that for a lot of high school athletes. I mean, they're trying to build up a following before they get to college to make. So yeah, and we're going down a rabbit hole here. I do want to ask you. So for somebody who comes in who's dysregulated, no emotional regulation, disconnected. You've got to have a process of helping them start to understand the why behind their emotions and make small changes.
Well,
how does that work?
Mike, what does it get like, that's like the second process. How does somebody know that they're dysregulated?
Yeah.
Like, cause that's the part that like I'm fascinated on. It's like, what's the rubric? Like, what do you put them in? What's the model to see if they are dysregulated? And then Mike's piece is almost a second. Then what do you do?
Yeah, I love that question because I think that that's where people can find agency in their life is by realizing that they can actually recognize what's going on with them. A lot of us feel that things are going wrong when we start feeling poorly, right? And so I think like that's a really good place to start is when you start realizing that your life feels out of balance, you're more irritable, you're snapping at people, you can't say yes to anything or you're saying yes to everything. I think understanding that your life is out of balance is an important first step. And how can we do that? We can do that by either doing an audit of what the last 2 weeks has felt like, right? And if you're not even there where you can do an audit, just notice if you've just been getting into a lot of small fights with people. That's a really good indicator that we're dysregulated. If you were snippy at the coffee place and the Uber person and your partner and your kid and at work and you're just overall feeling very irritable all the time, I think that's a good indicator that something is off balance. So that's how someone can realize if they're dysregulated. Another way we can recognize if we're dysregulated is if our bodily functions are off. So we are not sleeping well, we're not eating well, our hair is falling, or, you know, your body doesn't feel like it's working the way it used to. I think that's a really good sign. And what we do is we go to the doctor. We'll be like, okay, let me just get some blood work done. Maybe my iron is low. But that could be true, but that's a really good indicator that, you know what, something is off balance in my life. So that's how I would start.
And then the doctor's like, and here's a prescription.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what, I think it's always important to take a look at your life holistically. Like, I'm not anti-medication for anything at all, but it's not the only thing that will solve the problem. So I have, obviously I work with people who struggle with mental health issues, right? And I'm never the person who says, don't take the meds. But I'm also not the person who says, just take the meds, it'll be fine. Because we can't just rely on the one thing. We have to create habit changes. And if you need medication, use that support.
I think we're conditioned based off just the healthcare system as you look at the physiological part, not the psychological part. Mm-hmm. And I think as a society, we're getting smarter with that. But once somebody's, again, unbalanced, where does the process start?
If you're trying to break out of this hustle culture, toxic productivity mindset, and you've realized that, you know what, things are not feeling good for me anymore, I think what I encourage people to do, I did this myself and I do it with my clients as well, is to do a time energy audit. So that's when you can look back on the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks and really like pay attention to everything that you committed to, everything you said yes to, every task that you agreed to and you did, and pay attention to how you felt during and before and after. I think that will give you a pattern of what you are kind of constantly stuck in. Because what we want to do is we want to recognize the patterns that we are in. Once we can recognize the patterns, you don't just have to dismantle the pattern, but what you can do is you can change a few things so that you can start feeling better. And I can give you an example if that helps. So when I was struggling with this, one of the things that I realized after doing a lot of this like energy time audit is I realized that, and I'm a pretty self-aware person, but this can happen to anyone. I realized that I was committing to something every single day. I was going out 7 days a week while working. And it's because I had this mindset of optimizing my life. I was living in New York. I was in my early 30s. I was like, I should. And I was going out every single day. And that was just wrecking my body and my life. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating properly or not eating well when you're going out all the time. It costs a lot of money, right? And I realized I was saying yes to a lot of things because in my mind, I had this image of what it means to live in New York City. In my mind, I had this image of what I should be doing and what all my other friends are doing. And I was comparing myself. And I just wanted to live the most optimized life. And it was very unhealthy.
So for everyone listening, get off of Tinder and Bumble.
I was going to say, isn't that what you do in New York? Every time, like, I've never
that is what you do.
Well, I've never been to a place.
Assuming you're single at the time.
No, I was married. But I am married still. Okay. And he's like this too. So
you both were going out? Or?
Together, we were just like... Just oh, a toxic productivity
must
mess.
Be like a great. You must be great on these restaurants.
Misery loves company.
I love New York. I mean, New York pre-COVID was like one of the most amazing places. And then we went back after COVID, and it's like not. I don't know. Maybe it's returned a little bit.
The vibes are off a little bit. I don't want to get into it too much, but the vibes are off.
I think like pre-COVID. Like I've never in my life been to a place where, you know, 3 a.m. on a Tuesday you can go to a 5-star steakhouse.
Yeah.
And like sit down. I mean, like it was crazy because when I played for the Eagles, and so every Monday night we had a standing reservation at the China Club, which was pretty cool.
That is.
And we'd go with like the Yankees and Shockey and these guys from the Giants. And so I'd drive up and had a hotel room at the W, and we would just go out. And like New York was the coolest place on the planet.
It's still cool.
It is super cool. Yeah. But I think that's why it's really easy to get lost in the shuffle of it all. So not only was I working a full-time job, I was also starting my wellness platform, like my digital wellness platform. I was also going out all the time. It was just a lot. But the thing is, why was I doing all of this, right? Once I did an audit and I realized what I was doing, that's when I went into the, what is this bringing me if I'm feeling so like blah all the time, if I'm feeling so disconnected all the time? And I realized it was making me feel good enough, like good to belong, like I was doing the thing that made me good. Because that's what I should be doing. That's my mental model, right? And we don't question our mental models. We just inherit them, and then we just kind of continue on the path of who we're supposed to be. And I think it's really important to start questioning why you do the things you do.
Well, you also bring up a point, though, how rarely people take an audit of themselves. What are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? Where am I currently at? Where do I want to go? Yeah. And that's one of the biggest weaknesses I see in human beings as a whole is you're not the same person you were 5 years ago. You're not the same person you were a month ago. And people rarely take time to reflect and just think about, again, where they're at, how they're feeling, and where they want to go from there, or what changes they need to make to get there.
What's the old saying? A man never walks in the same river twice because the water is different and he is different. You know?
Oh my gosh, I thought that was from Pocahontas.
It was. John's a big Disney.
Oh.
Big Disney guy.
It's in Pocahontas?
Yeah, it's in the song.
I was an English philosophy, like a rhetoric major at Berkeley.
Oh, I'm sure someone else said it.
Yeah. So, but like, I'm pretty sure if I looked it up, but it was like a man doesn't walk in the same river twice, you know, because the water is different and he's different. And so I also don't understand people's desire to like look at what they think was like their heyday. This idea of like, I somehow peaked and like everything, like I joked with my kids that like, I'm still peaking every night. Like tomorrow's my best day. Tomorrow's my best day. And I run into a lot of people where it was like, oh, those were great days. And I'm like, yeah, no, the best one's ahead of me.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if there's an idea of, the age old, like if you live in the past, you're, you know, depressed. And if you live in the future, you're anxious. And like, you know, I think what happens so much with social media and maybe the present is this idea that everybody is living a better life than you, the FOMO.
Yeah.
And I try to explain this to my daughters. I'm like, it's a scam. This is like people putting their best foot forward. Like everybody thinks that they're doing everything that's great. And I'm like, those people all suck. So like, don't believe it.
Everybody has a hard life and there's good things that happen, but we only see the good stuff on social media. And I think the fear of missing out is a very real phenomenon because it's an anxiety and a fear of a lack of belonging. And we are just hardwired to feel belonging. And especially when we're younger, you know, we want to really belong with the rest of our peers. And so it taps into a really primal desire for belonging. And then we feel like if I continue to do more and I just shut down everything else, like I'm going to be like the rest of everybody. And then I'm going to have belonging and it'll be amazing. But it actually makes us feel lonelier.
But that you would find belonging over a social platform rather than connection with somebody in person.
Well, think about it, we're still dealing with the same processing, like the same hardware, I mean, the same physical that we had for like the last couple hundred thousand years. And think about like we lived in these probably small 150 like person groups. Mm-hmm. And our biggest fear was getting kicked outside the wall. So if you weren't in the group and they're like, we don't like you, then you're not by the fire. You're not inside the fence. So then they boot you out and you get eaten by wild animals or killed by, mm-hmm. I don't know, Vikings.
How many people do you hang out with on social media?
What's that?
How many of all your followers, how many people do you actually hang out with?
Well, Matt doesn't have social media. So one of like my actual training partner and then like the Brazilians and like my wife, I mean like a handful. But I purposely keep my circle very small.
Oh, I agree.
Just for the mere fact that it's not that I don't care, but I find that like if you bring in too much, it's overwhelming, and then I can't, like then I feel overwhelmed. Yeah. And when I feel overwhelmed, I shut down.
It's also time and energy she brought up.
Yeah.
The power of saying no, I think a lot of people miss out on that. As much as I want to help everyone, it's just like, hey, that's not.
Well, did you ever see the Jim Carrey Yes Man movie?
Yes.
Jim Carrey said yes, and he lived a great life. So like that movie to me is like, it is the dichotomy of life. He just said yes to everything. Next thing he's having this amazing life. But yet if you say yes to everything, then you're going to end up like, you know,
overworked. So that's an interesting thing, right? Because you want to say yes to opportunities, but you want to be able to decipher when it actually drains you. And then you want to be able to say no. So the problem that you're kind of speaking to is when you say yes, when you really want to say no or when you need to say no. But having that openness to what the universe or, you know, fate is bringing your way, I think is saying yes to what is coming your way. But I think being able to kind of decipher between, is this going to drain me, is really important. And yeah, saying no is one of the hardest things for people because we actually don't get taught how to say no. I'm seeing some parents do it now to young kids. Like, you know, they'll even say no to the grandparents to hug and you have to respect that. But I didn't grow up with that. Like I had to hug whoever my parents told me to hug, right? I had no say in that. I had to eat what they were telling me to eat. And so you don't learn the language to say no. And so one of the things I do a lot, because I work with a lot of Asian females, and just by virtue of gender and culture, saying no is something that we are just not trained for at all. So helping them develop that vocabulary and that language to say no that feels, in a way that feels comfortable, is really necessary. And also give them alternatives so that you feel comfortable in your own skin when you're saying no.
Is there I'm assuming this is within your repertoire of therapy is, you know, I'll get off a call and my immediate thought is I want to murder this motherfucker without sort of deciphering or getting into the nuance of why I feel that and dissecting it. I mean, do you feel that people just don't take the time to say, hey, wait, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling right now? And what does it mean? And what am I misconstruing?
Absolutely. So emotions are 90-second events in our brain. That is the life cycle of an emotion. Why do we continue to feel that emotion long after 90 seconds is because we have a story associated with every emotion. So what happens is we don't question that story. So you might get off the phone and you're like, I want to kill this guy because he activated some story in you about yourself, what you're entitled to, what you don't like. But we are not stopping to think, wait, am I actually entitled to this? Does he really owe me that? Or, you know, things like that. And so, yes, I don't think that people, I think we all believe our thoughts are true. And we think that there's only one truth and it's my truth and that's it. And so I think it's very uncomfortable to sit back and be so self-reflective, to ask yourself, wait, but is this true? The thing that I have felt for so long, is it true? And so people feel very uncomfortable. And some of my clients have also said, well, you're just asking me to not trust myself. And that's not what questioning yourself means. Questioning yourself means having an objective perspective on the thoughts that are coming in your mind and the feelings that you're having in your body. Not trusting yourself is not knowing what to do with it. And that's a different thing journey that you have to go on.
So one of the most impactful things for me, early on in college, I was a big stoic. And it probably messed me up. I think I've told you this. I was way too black and white. And then as I got older, I became more existentialist. But I have this quote on my phone, which you're going to laugh at. See if I can pull it up.
Is it from Pocahontas?
No. Let me see how I pull this thing up.
That was my bad.
No, dude.
But it's perfect. It's Marcus Aurelius. Ask yourself at every moment, is this necessary? So I ask myself this 1,000 times a day when I get into these things.
Yeah.
And I think you know, you're having a call on this, and I'm like, is this necessary? Is this person putting me in a good situation? How am I thinking about this? Mm-hmm. And I think that's you have to constantly, do you remember in Hunt for Red October when they were trying to find the bad guys and they kept pinging them to see how far the distance was on the sub? I think you got to actively ping everything. How do I feel about this? How close is this to me? And more importantly, should I be threat? Are they close enough to be a threat? Or is this something I can put away? So when I talk to people, I kind of actively ping this and figure out is this something that I have to manage? What's the threat level on this? And I think what happens for a lot of times is that there people go straight to what is it? DEFCON 1 is the high one. Is it? I always mess this up.
I think it is. That's my poor military knowledge.
A lot of times, I'm sure for you too, the people come in and they're giving you a problem and you're like, okay, what's the, is this person suicidal? No, you almost compartmentalize how much worry I give this.
Yeah.
And I think people don't take stock of all of the things that come through every day, you know? And
I think that's a great practice because what you're doing is you're kind of in this observation mind. And I think that's how we can build this self-awareness and intentionality is you're observing yourself. You're observing the interaction and you're kind of assessing how far the threat is and what you need to do as an appropriate reaction to it instead of overreacting or underreacting. So I think that's how you get there is everybody has a different way of getting there, right? Some people meditate. Some people do very extreme physical exercise. Some people do ice baths. Quotes are a really good way. Do you do a lot of ice baths?
Brought to you by Ice Barrel, which we have a competition going on. We're giving away a free Ice Barrel 500.
So
John was feeling very depressed and questioning his life until ice baths came into his life.
Wait, what's the max you've done?
So I've got the ice bath right out here.
Oh.
This is an ongoing piece of comedy,
okay.
Hilarity.
This is unintentional on my just end.
I am so happy you brought this up. I made the joke once that if the most difficult thing you do every day is you get in cold water for a few minutes, we have to literally reboot our entire lives.
Okay, well, and, it's very hard.
I know. But as an NFL player, I played in Green Bay at 7:30 at night in January in short sleeves.
It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies' slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details.
Save big money at Menards.
Have you or someone you know left the behavioral health field? Coming back has its benefits for you and Ohioans in need. We would love to have you back working at a community behavioral health center, and you could earn up to a $3,000 bonus. That's right, a $3,000 bonus. Visit mha.ohio.gov/welcomeback and restart your journey today. That's mha.ohio.gov/welcomeback.
It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies' slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details.
Save big money at
So, like, my, like, ability to monitor, is really high. So when I would talk to people and they were, like, telling me about these, like, ice, and I'm, like I just was, like, that's the hardest thing you've done in your life is getting in this ice bath. So it was kind of a joke. And then we started working with Ice Barrel, and they sent me this ice barrel. And my only frustration is I can't get it colder.
And so
We're in Texas, too. Yeah, the heat.
Minus max of 3 minutes.
You actually came to Texas. The temps drops significantly.
When I got here,
so great
it was,
time.
It's normally like 100 degrees all the
time.
So ice baths are, for me, it's less hard. I mean, he played in extreme conditions.
Also,
we were always
I'm
in the
like
water.
Like a thick steak.
Yeah.
Like I got a lot of, like, so like you got to remember, like you take a thick steak out of the refrigerator and you put it on the counter. It takes longer to thaw. Yeah. I'm a thicker steak. Mm. Like I like a smaller woman, like she's probably going to get colder a lot faster. I'm like a thick steak.
I know the point you're trying to make is for certain people, they have certain methodologies or mediums that help them sort of calm down, regulate. Ice bath to me is actually, it cools my body temp. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. So I'll do it 3-5 times a day. Oh. It just wakes me up.
Yeah.
That's it. But usually 3 to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And we had Wyatt on, who's the CEO of Ice Barrel, with phenomenal story.
Okay.
I mean, they're a leader in the industry. And
it's
basically
an amazing entrepreneurial story.
Oh, and, you know, he talks about really, what did he say? What was the temp? He's like, anything above 45 to 60 is technically in the range that you need to be. Anything below 45, it's just sort of personal preference.
I've only done it in spas, so I have no idea about.
So I did it 35 days in a row. Yeah, so 5 minutes.
This last 35 minutes.
Yeah, between like 40 and 43 was the goal. I don't know if autonomically or nervous system, it does, like, I felt fine. Like, by then I'd just go inside and kind of like, the other issue I would do is I'd stand out in the wind and I don't have a shiver response. That's another huge problem. He's like, oh, you got to stand out in the wind and then you get the shiver response, activates like the cold shock proteins and then what was it, like brown fats, no shiver response. Oh. So I think I'm emotionally broken.
No,
which
don't say that.
There's a
No.
I'm sure there's a lot of like my ex, I'm sure there's a series of ex-girlfriends and my wife who would just be like, yes, he's emotionally
Trust
broken.
Me, he would be a very lucrative client for you. Lots of money. You'd have to cancel all your other clients.
Just move to Austin.
Yeah.
You know, you talk a lot in the book about questioning the why behind your emotions and intention. I just wanted to dive into that. I mean, the why behind things, people just get into this rhythm of just do, don't question the you know, why they're doing it. It's just, again, that cycle of productivity. What is it about the question why that helps people sort of begin to process their emotions?
Well, when you ask the question why, your first reaction is to look for like an external reason. So we will try to find somewhere to put the blame of our uncomfortable feelings. But if you can sit through that and make it to the next stage of why, you start to see your own accountability. And while that feels extremely uncomfortable in the beginning, it is one of the most liberating things that you can do for yourself because it gives you clarity. It gives you so much clarity if you can see the role you are playing in, like, being an autopilot or, you know, the role you're playing in your own joy and your own misery. And I think that when I say that to people, their initial reaction is like, I don't want to think about this, or this is uncomfortable, or it is somebody else's fault. So what I really want people to understand is questioning the why helps you understand where you can find your power. And then you can influence change. And once you can influence change on yourself, you can actually influence change on your external circumstance as well. So you might perhaps not be able to yell at your boss if they're horrible, right? But you might be able to regulate your reaction to them so they don't make you feel as miserable. So you've taken away their power. And I think that's why understanding why you feel something is so necessary, but it is a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I'd say. I'd say people naturally go to the blame.
Yeah. Well, it's easier to feel defensive if you can put the, like, you know, like shouldering blame is hard. Like, it's so much easier to say everything's somebody else's fault. Mm-hmm. You know, and like, this is something that I teach my kids all the time. Like, I'll just give you an example of like, you know, like, this is so stupid, but we have like a little, like a side-by-side. We live on like kind of a ranch. And my one daughter's 13 and she'll use it to go over to the barn next door because she rides horses. And I was having some problems. And so I was trying to like troubleshoot it. And she's like, well, it's not my fault. I don't do this. And I was like, I don't really care whose fault it is. It's just like the thing's not working. You got to fill it with gas. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to like do this teaching moment. My wife's like, did you yell? And I'm like, I didn't yell at her. She said you were being mean to her. I'm like, no, I was trying to teach her a lesson about responsibility.
Yeah.
And like now I've realized that like even like a less of a responsibility can feel like you're being attacked when you're asking somebody to take ownership in something that might, you know, they might either view as not their fault. Mm-hmm. And so like that was a kind of an awakening for me where I was like, man, like I'm always like, I'm real big on mentorship. If somebody can provide me mentorship or explain something better that alleviates me having to bump my head into the wall, mm-hmm. I'll take it. Like my dad made a good point to me once where he's like, if you have to make every mistake yourself, you're going to have a really painful life. Yeah. Learn from the mistakes of others. And so I always like, if you have knowledge that I need, I'm going to listen and then I'm going to implement it. Like instead, whereas I think a lot of people that aren't maybe as evolved are like, that's not how I'm feeling. And they're like, almost like angry against it. Mm-hmm. Side note, do you know Tara Swart? Have you never met Tara Swart?
No.
She's a doctor from India.
Okay.
She's a neurosurgeon. She has a book that's called The Source.
Okay.
We had her on the podcast.
But you do understand that India is a different country than Pakistan.
But she's also a clinical. I just wondered if you had, because some of the things you've said.
We're in the same field.
Yeah. Yeah. Very similar in that, you know, like your perception becomes your reality.
100%.
And so just there was some threads that were very similar. Yeah. We've had a few podcasts with her. I read her book. I actually think she's an amazing person. And like, if there was an ability for me to like hire her to be a therapist, I'd be like, dude, I'm in.
It seems like more people are seeking therapy that may not necessarily need it, but they just view it as a checkup from the neck up. It's almost like just
oil change.
Well,
wasn't there a feeling that like if you had therapy, you were going because you were insane? Like I kind of like, and, my wife's like, you should go to therapy. I'm like, I got a podcast.
Have you seen the memes? Men will do anything except go to therapy.
Yes. Yes.
So my, just a little personal deal. My daughter, so I have twin daughters. Mm-hmm. My one daughter got attacked by our neighbor's dog.
Oh,
and it's pretty gnarly. And, my other daughter, she basically fought for her life. The dog could have killed her. But my other daughter had to stand and watch it. So she's been in therapy, you know, the survivor's guilt and this thing. And so we've been navigating
That's so terrible.
Awful.
Yeah.
Whereas my other daughter's super resilient. And it's like, it happened. I'm fine.
Oh, wow.
And whereas my other daughter who watched it is kind of like had a bunch of problems. So I went to go meet with her therapist. Uh-huh. And her therapist was like so switched on. I like left there and I was like, I told my wife, I'm like, that woman was amazing. We agreed on everything. And she's like, and like my wife's like, take it to me. What did you mold or something? I'm like, no, she said, if you're having a stressful day, go work out. Like, dude, you know, like if you feel sorry for yourself, like pick yourself up and go accomplish something that you know is easy. And like, whether it be in an ice bath or swinging a kettlebell or training in this. And I listened and I was like, I've been saying this all the time. I think we've gotten to a point where people don't do enough hard stuff in their day and they don't like expel this out of their system. Like when you got out and you worked 40 hours a week, you probably came home and you're like, I'm tired. And now we just, you know, people sit all day and they don't have enough like physical exertion. So
we are believers that, you know, with the Everyday Warrior, we talk about physical fitness, mental fitness, spiritual fitness. We're believers that physical fitness is sort of the foundational to the others.
Sure.
I mean, research has shown your ability to deal with stress, if your cardiovascular health is much higher, is more potent. But
well, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, agree.
Like, if you're not physically well, then you could be. You can have a lot of mental health, but you're still going to feel bad because your body perhaps not be working. Maybe you have like a chronic illness or something like that, right? And you could be at peak physical health, but if you don't care for your mental health, then you will feel disconnected from life, right? And so I think they both have to come together. But to your point, I think that physical activity is an extremely important antidote to feeling poorly, like in your mental health, you know, because we do have to shift the energy. So one of the things I always say to people is if we've had a really hard therapy session, you have to leave the room. Right? Like, get out of the room. We just had the session in. Go for a walk. Go for a run. Go dance. Like, it doesn't have to be a hard workout because maybe that's not accessible to everyone, but you have to move your body. Go for a really brisk walk because it does help stabilize some of the stress hormones in your body that are making you feel worse. So I think that's really important.
You know, funny enough, and I was talking to my wife about this, is in her previous jobs, you had time to work out. You had a lot of time. And you were carefree in the sense that your job required that. Mm-hmm. Now I go to the gym. One, I've got to put my phone on airplane mode. But in the back of my head is I'm like thinking of the checklist of everything I have to do. And it has cut some of my workout short by like 30, 45 minutes. I'm like, dude, I got to go. I've got like a ton of work to knock out.
We live on a big property. I have a big building full of equipment. Uh-huh. And so I have a gym. And we all train there. And like the guys that I, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys I train there. And a few other people like come in, and my wife has some like groups, and like so, our house is here and the building's here, and I can look out our kitchen window and see the building, and it's kind of like, I don't know, the fortress of solitude where you're like, it's calling me, I gotta go, and then people show up or people will text me like, hey, I'm swinging by, like so it's kind of, I mean, we're behind a gate, so I know when people come, but it's really good, and then I have a good community, like the, you know, Brazilians text me like, hey, come to Jits, I haven't seen you, and so I have people that are kind of like not chasing me around a little bit, but like people,
just community.
Yeah.
In being friends. In community with people who are like-minded, who make you feel good about yourself.
And they're happy to see you. Like they always have a smile and it's like, oh, we missed you yesterday. And I think that sense of belonging to a tribe or a group and feeling like, these are my friends. These are the people I want to be around. They have a smile and like that good energy. Yeah. Like that's what I think to me.
Very
like,
healing.
Yeah, but that's fitness and that's training.
Absolutely.
And I feel sad for people that don't have that community.
Yeah, I mean, community is like a cornerstone of our mental health and our societies, right? And I think you were saying earlier that, you know, people are more dysregulated. There's like a lot of airport meltdowns now. And I see it on TikTok all the time. It's also because we have a little bit of a lack of community. People are very alone. And when we're alone, we're not supposed to regulate alone. We're supposed to co-regulate with people. And as human beings, right? And so I think that is a big part. And one of the reasons we are lacking community is because we're all too busy trying to do too much stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not trying to bring it back, but I genuinely do believe this. How many times have I had friends who are like, oh, you know, I'm not going to make it to dinner because I still have some work to do. Or I've been like, oh, you know, I can't actually do this thing anymore because I have to finish this video or this content or this article. And we can really disregard our community in service of productivity. We do it a lot and it makes us lonelier. And then we're like, why do I feel so bad? And then you don't really have an answer. So then you do other stuff to feel good about yourself. And it's just like a vicious cycle. So I think that it's really important, again, to be very intentional about where we're putting your energy. And to me, like kind of redefining what is meaningful productivity. It's not just in service of the work that you're doing, but we have to be better in our relationships and our health and our relationship to ourselves.
What about alcohol?
What about it?
Like that's an interesting piece where like, you know, the greasing of the groove, we're now...
Were you offering her a drink?
No, but like, but like, is that, as I'm thinking about like the community thing, like this, and I'll just give you an example. So my wife like had her tonsils out, so like... I'm not like a big drinker. Like it just doesn't matter. Like if I had a drink, like, or if I didn't drink, it didn't, like, it doesn't move the needle for me. But we didn't drink for like 40 days. And I was like, oh, do you feel better? So we had people over recently for a barbecue and they were all doing Sober October. Mm. And so we were sitting there and like, I didn't realize how uncomfortable they were.
Yeah.
By like not only Sober October, but also we like cooked a bunch of food and they were all like eating a little bit. And I was like, oh, are they all taking Ozempic?
Oh.
I was like, oh man, I cooked way too much food because these people are either on Ozempic and they're not drinking alcohol. And I was like, because normally like people eat, they show up, they have drinks, they have a good time. Yeah. They weren't eating and they weren't drinking. And I was like, I asked my wife, I'm like, what happened? She's like, that was super weird. They weren't drinking and I think they were taking Ozempic because everybody had like this much food.
Aww. I'm so tired of hearing about Ozempic.
Well, I was stoked because we had a ton of leftovers and I barbecued and I ate a ton of steak to the point where I was like, I can't eat more steak. And these people were over there like, I'm so full. I'm like, you didn't even eat anything. And so then I realized I'm like a food pusher where I'm like, here, let me give you a little bit more. Like, I'm not like the alcohol pusher. I'm like the food pusher. But I'm like, God damn it, these Ozempic people.
It's merely a shortcut. I'm not saying that there's medicinal uses for it with people with severe obesity.
Or diabetes.
Yeah. Absolutely, which was like, originally like intended for. It
to lose a few extra pounds.
I mean, they're really pushing it on the ads. I see it everywhere on the trains. And I feel like there's a lot of unknown health complications if you're taking any medication off-label use. So that's a different conversation. But to your point about alcohol, I think that North American, European culture is very alcohol-centered, right? And so when we feel stressed, it's very normal to have a drink to de-stress. It's just kind of like in the way we think about, you know, relaxation. But it's not the same in other parts of the world. So alcohol is just like a cultural thing that we do here. And it can lead to negative outcomes if you're relying on it to de-stress. But that could be for anything. It could be for food. It could be for shopping. It could be for porn. It could be for sex, right? Like when you are stressed out, you're not taking care of yourself, you're not going inwards to think about what's really wrong, you're going to try to fill the void with something that gives you a quick hit of dopamine. And so that's really what it is. So I think people should definitely drink with caution. That's my two cents.
Moderation is king. I mean, Americans take things beyond. Yeah. I do. When I moved here in 2015, dude, I hadn't drinking in like a year and a half. Uh-huh. Best shape of my life.
Yeah.
And didn't have a tribe, didn't have a community here, but quickly met some, you know, all professionals, medical device sales, lawyers. And it was, we were out on Thursday night till Sunday night. Every night out drinking, it was the center point of the group. Alcohol was the center point. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 2 years and I met Jordan and I just did an Irish goodbye. Like they text me, hey, we're going out. And I ran into some of them like 6 months later. They're like, bro, you dusted us. I'm like, I just had to stop.
Yeah.
Cause that was what Thursday to Sunday night, that's what we did.
Yeah.
And everything intense. Revolved around alcohol and it just got tiring.
It feels overwhelming. I mean, like I've said, like we didn't drink for like 40 days. And like the only, like the biggest benefit was we had a sponsor, 8Sleep, on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And they gave me one of their systems and that gives me a score for my sleep.
Yeah.
So since I realized that one drink affects my sleep for a few days and actually every day was like a 98 to 100.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, God damn it.
It
like
does. It affects your sleep. Yeah. It affects your skin.
And I got super competitive on getting these high scores on my sleep.
Yeah.
And I wasn't willing to give it up. And I'm like, God damn it. Now I'm gamifying my life and like trying to like make all these things.
It's a good outcome.
Yeah. It just, it was just weird to me that like you could see how uncomfortable people were. Where I'm like, so now we have to have a drink to feel like connected and to have these good conversations. And that's kind of a scary realization.
Yeah, and I think that we're contending with the overuse of alcohol as a society right now because of the sober curious movement, right? Like a lot of people are not drinking. I have a lot of friends who don't drink anymore. I have a Muslim background, so like that's not a part of my culture at all. So when non-Muslim people came to my wedding, there was a lot of tension around the fact that there was no alcohol. You know, there was a lot of like nervousness about it being a dry wedding.
Did you drink during your own wedding? No, you didn't?
No. Yeah.
You still have fun?
Yeah. Even if I was a drinker, I probably wouldn't drink at my wedding because like it just gets so messy. Sloppy. Yeah. But the point is, I don't think that alcohol in itself is like the worst thing in the world. I think we're self-medicating because we're a very stressed out society.
Yeah. I think there's also a feeling too that like our present day is the worst. Like, oh my God, it's never been this bad. And then you go back and like, I think in the 1800s, the average person for every American drank like 1.5 quarts of of alcohol per day, and that included children.
But their life expectancy was like 40.
Oh, and they also had miserable lives. Can you imagine?
Bad teeth, like getting
in a covered wagon and walking across America, mm-hmm. and like half of the people get killed by like Indians and plague and dysentery, and you're like,
bears.
Oh my God, bears. Yeah. So whenever people are like, oh, we have it so rough, I'm like, all you have to do is watch any, like watch, what was it? The Yellowstone, the 1800s yes. Yellowstone. Yeah. And I'm yeah. like, well, we got a pretty good life.
People lack perspective. I love these books because there's always some nuggets that you can take and just implement in your life. Here's my fear with society. And you even saw it during COVID. COVID hit. You probably heard of the Great Resignation.
Yeah.
People are just like, hey, I don't like my job. I'm going to quit. And then it led to the Great Resignation because there was no money coming in. They realized they couldn't pay their bills. Yeah. Is people have a tough time differentiating between, hey, life is just hard work. And if you want to accomplish great things, you're going to have to work hard. Bottom line, that's you can't really dive further than that. But a lot of people take this and they're like, well, I just need to quit work and just focus on my mental health. And I understand that. Where's the balance in all of it?
Yeah. That's a really important point. And I want to, before I answer that question, I want to pose a question to you. You said, you know, life is hard work. If you want to do great things, you have to work hard. My question is, are things worth doing if they're not great?
You're talking, you're a high achiever. We can see it. We're high achievers. I mean, John in the NFL, like we're breaking world records in skydiving. Like I don't, I'm miserable unless we have another expedition where we're going to break mm-hmm. some world record. Because one, I'm with the boys, and let me caveat, love my wife, love my family.
Of course.
But we're also going through, we're all going through shared adversity together.
I don't know why doing you had something to tell tough. Us that it's kind of assumed.
And
I think it was telling me.
just letting you know. If I'm not doing something hard, then I start to feel like I'm dying. Hmm. And that's when I start not feeling good about myself.
Yeah.
Doubt creeps in. And maybe that is also a byproduct of the 20 years in special operations where we were constantly deploying and we loved it. That's what we lived for.
And you're also compartmentalizing emotions, which I think is survival, is healthy. Like you have to do it at some point. But so it's important to do hard things because when we challenge ourselves, when we learn something new, it not only helps us feel more competent and resilient, it actually reprunes our neural network in our brain. So our brain is becoming sharper every time we learn something new or we push ourselves. But hard things don't have to be great things. And I really want to make a distinction there because we are constantly pursuing this concept of greatness where everything that is perhaps average seems mediocre or like a failure. And that pushes us to feel bad about ourselves, to do more, to compare, to compete, right? And the goalpost keeps moving on what is great, right? So that is a recipe to burnout. Some things can be mediocre in life and that's okay. You can have a mediocre night. You can go to a mediocre restaurant. You can have a mediocre skydiving event or whatever it is. I mean, I want you to... No. that's not what I meant. But like, you know, I think it's okay that some... Because life is meant to be a mix of average, mediocre, and exceptional together. And that's what makes life dynamic.
Yeah.
Because nothing will ever feel as good as the first time you hit greatness. And you're just going to keep chasing it. You chase that high and then you're going to burn out. And you're going to demand that from other people. You're going to demand it from your partners. If you have children, you'll demand it from them. And then you become a very disconnected person from your family and your friends. So to me, as an overachiever myself, like I'm a child of immigrants, I'm an immigrant myself, there's no other option besides being an overachiever. But it's something I've actually had to talk to my parents about a lot, is that it's okay that we are just normal in some parts of our life. And in other parts of our life, we can achieve the greatness that we want. And that makes my life more dynamic. So that's just my little side note.
No. That was so beautifully. No. That was so beautifully stated. And I know that is, it can be a strength. It's also one of my weaknesses. Mm. And you brought something up. I don't want to push that on my kids. Mm. Because there are many dark things about my life that come with that pursuit of what is the next Ridgeline, what is the next great thing. I heard, and I had, his name is Dr. Johnny Kim.
Okay. He's like every Asian parent's like dream.
He's like the astronaut
every
SEAL.
Every Asian kid's nightmare, because their parents are like, hey, look, he's a doctor and an astronaut.
And a Navy SEAL. So I went to BUDS with him. We went through SEAL training, and then we deployed twice to combat. The most, I mean, he's soft-spoken.
Yeah.
Just sincere, genuine, and just the most empathetic guy. He's the perfect human. And I hate to put that on him, but
I can't believe he was a SEAL.
I think growing up in an Asian home, I think his dad put a lot of stress on him to, you know, you have to be perfect. You have to be perfect. But he learned from it. And I mean, to be one of his kids, like that's a lot of pressure. But he said, yeah. I tell my kids, all I ask is that you find your passion in life, whether it's being a pianist or an artist or a teacher. And the only thing I ask is don't use what I've achieved as your metrics for success. Yeah. Identify your own, pour into it, love it, and impact others. And if you do that, you're going to have a, let's say, impactful and purpose-filled life. That's all he asks. But I don't know. My life is measured by accomplishments. My family is an important part of that. But for me, that's just... it's a driver. And I'm not looking for external, applause whatsoever. If that was the case, I'd be all over social media, and I'm not. Mm-hmm. But even with you and I in this initiative, like, where are we taking it? What's the next best thing? How are we impacting people?
I don't know. So for a lot of things, I don't know if you can hear me, but I'll say for the SI thing, I never know what the play of the, like, I don't know how everything's going to play out until I get into it. So, like, for this thing, I didn't really go into it with any, metric for success or any, like, you know, self, like, desire. Like there was nothing for, like, it looked like a really cool initiative. There was a lot of things that stacked into it. But once we get into it and we start seeing the way it goes, then I'll be able to figure it out. Like, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I think people go into everything with these like preconceived notions. I want it to be this and this and this. Yeah. This is what I want my marriage and my kids. Everything is so dynamic that the stress of putting that weight on you before something, like, we're going to do it. If it turns out great, then you know what, we're going to keep doing it. If it sucks, I'll know in 3 months and we'll pull the cord. Like, I found that if I remove a lot of the expectation early on and I let things kind of organically grow, like, I put that seed in the ground and I know it's going to grow. When it sprouts, is going to be dictated on nothing that I can do. But as it grows big, now I can start to culture it and figure it out more. But that initial, like, sprouting, that's going to happen. And so I don't go into the expectation anymore. Like, I started really limiting, because for a lot of times you put all this emphasis up front, I wanted to do this and this, and then it doesn't sprout when you want, you feel like a bit of a failure. So what I found is that if I don't put a lot of expectation in the beginning, and then once I see it go, then I'll pour gas on it. And like, that's with, like, whether it be training or anything, I always kind of, like, you know, walk in a little bit slower, kind of reduce my, like, optics a little bit, and I see how it all kind of plays out. And then once I get there, then I assess it. But, like, assessing it before I get there, I don't do that anymore. All it's done is set me up for fucking disaster and disappointment.
You sound emotionally dead. You're just coasting through life, John.
Yeah.
Maybe we are not the best. I'm joking. I did realize this.
No, but this is, I think you get to a point, right? Like, I used to watch this, and maybe a lot of this comes from the NFL, right? Like, we're going to go out there, and I'd listen to these rah-rah speeches, and we would go out there and get our teeth kicked in on the first series, and you'd see these coaches tearing things up, like flipping out and going all wild. And I was always like, there's 60 minutes in this thing. We're going to be out here for 3 hours. I'm going to run 72 plays. You guys are ready to cash it in after the first four. I was like, let's just get out here and get in a groove and see how this goes up. Because at the end of the day, they're not going to grade us by what we did on the first series. They're going to grade us on what the final score is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, with my kids, like, trying to explain to them, like, okay, you guys are in seventh grade. The reason you have to get good grades is so that you do better when you get to eighth grade, and then eventually you go on and you get to high school, and you know, you take SATs and you get good grades and you go to college. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I went to college. I just happened to find something I really enjoyed, which was reading and writing.
Yeah.
And Adrian Cragen, who was the dean of the UC Berkeley Law School, and he was an old guy, I had a meeting with him on my trip to Berkeley. He said, hey, if you want to learn to think, you have to learn to read, to write, and write to the best of your ability. And he's like, here's his major, and I did it. And, like, I learned to read and write. And how would I know that reading and writing and thinking were what I've done for the last 12 since I retired from the NFL? And it's I didn't know this, how it would play out. But I also didn't set, so like, oh, if I don't get into business school, if I don't do this. I was like, I think people put so much pressure on themselves. I think about, like, a woman, like the pressure of her wedding. I planned this thing for 2 years, and it's going to be perfect. I showed up and I was like, hey, let's have a great time. I hope the music's good.
Yeah, as a guy, my boys are here. We're going to drink.
We're going to have a good time. But I think there's this idea that people build in their head that, like you were saying, like comparison is the thief of joy. But they build this idea in their mind of what it should be. I want to see what it is once I get to the party. Like, is this party going to suck? I don't know. We're going to go and we're going to see how it is. But I guarantee if I can, you know, pour the drinks and set the music, we're going to have a great time.
I'll agree with you on the expectation thing. And I had great advice. The reason I joined the Marine Corps was I met this Force Recon Marine, just like as an 18-year-old, you looked up to this guy. He was just everything you wanted to be. And Force Recon is the special operations community of the Marine Corps at the time. And he said, hey, as I was leaving for boot camp, he's like, let me give you one key piece of advice. He said, nothing will meet your expectations of what you think the Marine Corps or the military will be. And I think what I had become is this romantic version of the military and special operations based off The Rock or Navy SEALs with Charlie Sheen. And it was the best piece of advice. But I think I've taken it too far in the sense that I remember doing like combat missions that like we put a lot of preparation into and we were successful. And like, we should be joyful that we pulled it off. We brought all the guys home. And it was like it was a shoulder shrug, and like the other guys around me would be like, "Okay, yeah, no, that's cool. What's next?" And I'm like, I knew at some point, I'm like, "Okay, this is really unhealthy."
Yeah.
But we're just gonna keep on going. It's no, like motion is lotion. That, like just keep on going.
That's not unhealthy, because what I learned is too high, too low. Right, like burns you out. So like if you can kind of stay middle of the road on a lot of things, one, you keep a better sense of well-being. And like big highs, big lows make me really nervous. Like if I'm around people that are up and down and up and down.
Oh, that's exhausting.
Mm-hmm. I can't be around them.
Yeah.
Like I'll tell people, I'll be like, dude, like you're not the right person for me.
Yeah.
I need like jazz, even keel, background music. Like let's just go like move the dirt. Like I made this quote on a podcast years ago. Like life's a lot like moving dirt. Like you just got to basically like shovel. Some days you get a big spoon, some days you get a big shovel, you know, but as long as you're moving a little bit every day, you are moving towards your goal.
Yeah.
And like, that's just been the consistency piece. And I feel like people that are big ups and big downs can't be consistent because of the emotional ups and downs. And like the age old, like, you know, when the wind blows, put your shoulder and just keep moving. Like that's what success is. I mean, there's, you know, you think about how long does it take to be a you know, successful person? Years. You know, I want to be the best overnight success on the planet, right?
It took me 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years.
Still not there.
Well, I mean, I want to say one thing about this expectation conversation that we're having, because I think it is really important to have expectations out of life, because it gives us hope, it gives us optimism, it gives us resilience, and it gives us motivation. But you're right. You can't have expectations that are too high, because chances are it's not going to be like that. And I mean, I remember my first learning of this was prom. I thought prom was going to be this like magical thing, but it was like really just a party with my same people I saw at school, right? And however, having very low expectations, right, takes you to a place where you were, where you're not able to celebrate the achievement. You're not able to celebrate the win and really savor it. So we don't get that feedback loop. We don't even acknowledge it. You just turn to say, well, what's next now? And so I think having that middle balance is really important. And the way we can get to that middle balance is to have a very objective analysis of the situation that requires you to have a very realistic view of yourself and your skills and a realistic view of the circumstance you're in. But I've often heard the phrase low expectation, high reward. And I find that to be, and this is just my opinion, I find that to be very pessimistic. It's very guarded. Like, people have their walls up. And what happens is, if you live a lot of your life with walls up, people can't get to you. And you feel misunderstood, you feel lonely, and you might not be able to accept love or success or achievement in the same way because you have that wall up. Mm. So I think it's coming back to the whole emotions conversation, that it requires a lot of emotional awareness. But it's an interesting perspective. We all have there's like three different opinions on the table, and I love that, because a lot of podcasts I go to, we're saying the same thing. This is the first time where people are saying different things.
Well, we're very unique individuals, and we're highly skilled at this. I like to think we're good professionals.
I like it. This has been very engaging.
I think the expectation, like, that people put on stuff, put so much pressure on everybody else around them that if they almost like, this party's going to be amazing. Like, I'm not going to say that until I show up and I see how the whole thing goes down. I'm always weird. Like my wife and I will pick a restaurant. She's so excited about it. And we get there and she's like, what do you think? I'm like, I don't know. I'm going to tell you when the food shows up, but we're going to have a good time. We're still going to go. And then she'll be like, it didn't really meet my expectations. She's like, what do you think? I'm like, I thought it was awesome. I loved it. We got to go out. We got to sit at some place. We got to eat some food.
Yeah.
Would I go back there? Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. And she's like, you're so even keel about this. Can't you get up and down? And I'm like, well, I've been to a lot of restaurants. I've eaten a lot of really good food. Like, if I could go back. But the other problem is, I'm a pretty good cook. So, like, I'm a pretty good cook, and I like when I cook, I like what I cook. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a funny thing, but, like, you think about it with, I think there's such a pressure to have everything be the greatest, and I run into a lot of people that everything's the best right up until the point it's not, and then it's the worst, and I fucking hate that. That, like, drives me crazy that people are, like, all in. Oh, one little thing. Like, let's say the SI thing. Oh, it's not going as well. I thought this was going to be amazing. Fuck this. I don't want to do it. And I'm like, everything takes work.
Oh, it takes time.
Yeah, it takes time. So, like, give it, like, the room it needs to grow. And then all of a sudden, like, then we can take stock of it. But, like, that, like there's so much expectation. I think people fucking kill everything with it.
That is society as a whole. If it's not working out within the first 30, 60, 90 days, people cut, tail and run.
Yeah.
And some things just take time. It's that one step at a time approach I talk about. You don't climb Everest in one giant leap.
How do you?
It takes 70,000 steps. And how many steps went into the preparation? Probably 7.5 million from people I've talked to that trained for 1 year, averaging 20 to 25,000 steps a day in preparation to climb it.
We had that guy on the podcast about who climbed Everest and the whole thing. Remember that?
Elia?
Yeah.
Oh, he's freaking. So he's Canadian. Male model. Uh-huh. It looks the part, like Blue Steel, but documentary filmmaker and just.
So we had him on the podcast, and he was talking about climbing Everest. There is no part, like, all these people are like, man, it'd be amazing. I'm like, nope. There isn't any part of climbing Mount Everest that I would ever want to go into.
Well, it's, like, the time. Once you get out there, it usually takes anywhere from 1 to 2 months before you actually start.
It's a one-year process. Like, you got to get there.
It's also a high death rate. Like, a lot of people
die. You can pay a Sherpa to carry you to the top now.
Which is the American thing. It's to...
Just to say you did it, to get the picture. And then there's people, like, I saw the picture, there's like hundreds of people waiting to get to the top, to get to it. And this one guy who was a rich guy, he didn't even walk. This Sherpa carried him the whole way. And at that point, I was like, this is ridiculous. I will never do this.
So we actually went to Everest and skydived.
Oh, my goodness.
Around, not onto, but drop zones next to Everest. And it was great. We flew in. We jumped. Did it in 14 days, jumped in multiple places in Nepal and took off. And we're like, that was awesome.
That, to me, sounds like a party.
We're like, great. Some guys got tandemed in. Isra, this book is going to impact a lot of people. I want to give you the last sort of minute or two to just, you know, run through why people should read this, what you think they'll gain from it, and then we'll close it out because you've got to go see Austin.
Yeah, and I do.
Lots of much barbecue more, as a pescatarian.
Austin is much more enjoyable than John and I are. So
no, this was a very, very engaging conversation. I genuinely want people to use this book as an entry point into self and introspection. This is not going to change your life. You're not going to read any one singular book that's going to change your life forever. So don't come in with that mindset. But I want people to use, because the book has a lot of reflections. There's lots of journal journaling entries that you can do. And I was very intentional about that because I want people to get in the habit of sitting with themselves. So you don't have to rush through this book. You don't have to finish it cover to cover. Definitely don't make it a part of a reading challenge. Take your time, do the exercises, do the reflection. And I want you to leave this book feeling a little bit more insightful about yourself. So that's like my biggest thing that I want people to have, is because once we start self-awareness, it's really hard to close it. And that's a good thing, right? Once you become aware, once you start seeing things about yourself or your parents or your, you know, the way you show up in relationships or at work, once you start seeing it, you can't unsee it. And then the journey is just onwards to being more and more connected with yourself. So yeah.
That is the most honest answer I've ever heard from an author, because there's so many authors that think their book will change the world. And it's the absolute truth.
I just love the fact that she's talking about managing expectations. I feel like I've influenced her in some way. She's like, I want to manage your expectations. This isn't going to change your life, but it's going to be, if you get through, it's going to be groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Exactly as it should be.
Well, I'm a middle child, so I always manage expectations.
I'm the youngest of three.
I'm also Libra.
Youngest as well.
Yeah,
I'm the youngest. You both have that energy. You both have the youngest child energy. Yeah.
And I'm just going to say it, we're the sort of models of our family, you know?
Both my brothers are insanely successful. But my older brother's such a dick. He's like, it's funny. I'm glad that my middle brother and I are tight, because like, we like see it and you'd be like, your older brother's crazy. I'm like, I knew it. And, you know, but it's just inside joke that we have going.
The reason I say it is because it is true. Right? Like, I've been a therapist for 10 years. Nothing singularly changes your life. It is just a series of small shifts that you turn around. A year goes by and you're like, wow, my life is fully different. But nothing, one thing does not actually just change your life.
Do you feel nervous when people say, oh my God, this changed my life? Like when people say that to me, I get like, was your life that like rocky, that one little thing tilted it?
No, you know what? I realize when people say that is that it shifted something that was so important for them, that had a ripple effect. But many other things had to happen in order for their
multiple
life to
modalities
change.
That led to it. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I want to reemphasize this book, Toxic Productivity: Reclaim Your Time and Emotional Energy in a World That Always Demands More. Out on November 19th, which we'll post this that week. Mm-hmm. Amazon is probably the best place to go pick it up.
And then also give her website. Her website's incredible. She has like so many resources in this. Like it was like a whole ecosystem, and I was really impressed with it.
Actually, Jordan came in when I was looking at her website, and she's like, who is that? I'm like, somebody we're bringing on the podcast. Oh, okay.
I was really impressed. I thought I was really switched on. I liked that it was like this kind of like ecosystem of different pieces, the book and the help. It's really well done.
You're still accepting clients in New York?
December onwards.
So you're kicking off the practice in December.
Yeah, I took a little bit of a break.
You also mentioned you have an online platform.
Yeah.
Which?
So I'm very active on Instagram. It's called @well.guide. And through there, you get a lot of resources because it's linked to my newsletter. There's a community. We do a monthly, community event or gathering where we talk about stuff, and I send out a newsletter twice a month.
And that's isranasir.com, I'm assuming. We'll post all those links. Can't thank you enough for coming out to New York. Enjoy Austin. The only recommendation I'll make is Ranch 616.
Okay.
Was my joint. Many dates there. I tell my wife, that's why she doesn't like to go there anymore. But it is iconic in Austin.
I was trying to think of like pescatarian. I mean, almost like you'd have to go to Uchi or Ichido, because they don't do really fish here.
Every time I go to Uchi, I'm hungry when I leave, and I'm really pissed off.
And you spent a lot of money.
Is that a sushi place?
Yeah, it's really good, though. It's excellent. But yeah, I mean, there's, coming from California, I have this weird thing where I don't like necessarily eat fish if it's not near the ocean.
Fair.
So, like, I just feel weird eating fish in Texas. So, like, we'll get, like, frozen fish come in. I don't know. It's kind of which.
No, it's the safest sushi. Worst sushi I've ever. Well, I shouldn't have done it. It was in Djibouti. Probably not the best place to have sushi, but. Yeah. The food service industry is not too regulated over there. Well, guys, Toxic Productivity by Isra Nasir. Go check it out on Amazon. Purchase a copy. Help her get on that New York Times bestseller list.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks for your time out here.
It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies' slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details.
Save big money at
Have you or someone you know left the behavioral health field? Coming back has its benefits for you and Ohioans in need. We would love to have you back working at a community behavioral health center, and you could earn up to a $3,000 bonus. That's right, a $3,000 bonus. Visit mha.ohio.gov/welcomeback and restart your journey today. That's mha.ohio.gov/welcomeback.